one came expecting. Maybe I'll wait. All right, welcome to our class. Nathan is out of town today, and so he'd called me and asked me to fill in for him. I asked him what I need to be teaching on. You can turn me down just a little bit more if you would. What I need to be teaching on, he said, I don't know. I get up on Sunday morning and try to figure out what I'm going to do, so you do the same thing. We know that that's not quite true. However, probably he does ruminate on it a bit on Sunday mornings, I would suspect. But we're glad that you're with us, and I want to say Happy Mother's Day again. By the way, most of you probably know that Nathan has a little book out entitled, I think it's something like Christ at the Coffee Shop, and he's agreed to use that, the proceeds from that, to help Tyrone in his mission work. So if you don't have a copy of that, then you can kill two birds with one stone, and you can see Tyrone or see Nathan and get a copy of that book. And by the way, I think he mentioned this one time during the class. He's in the process of turning this class into a book also, about not letting fear scare you to death. So hopefully that book also will be coming out. And I think those of us who've been in the class have gotten a foretaste of it, that we know that it'll be something worth reading and giving to people as a gift also. So everybody that sits out here in Nathan's class has some comments to make, and most of you stifle yourself and you don't make them. But getting up and teaching the class gives you a chance to say what it is you wanted to say. So I thought it was kind of interesting. Nathan started his class out last time by talking about what kind of life would you live if you didn't have anything to lose. And the first thing that struck me about that was that you remember, how many of you have seen the movie Fiddler on the Roof? You remember the main character would make a statement and then he would say, but on the other hand, and then he would make a statement and he'd say, but on the other hand, you remember that? Through the movie, several different times he would say that. And we all kind of laughed, you know, when he said that, but there is something that reveals also. And that is, when you examine something, in order for it to be really, really accurate, you have to put it within, if it requires a limiting context, then you have to put that there. Because certain things are true within a context. And then there are some things that are not true in every context. And so there is a sense in which you can say, I don't have anything to lose. Right? But there is a sense in which we always have something to lose. I mean, if we might not have anything other than our life, but we have something to lose, don't we? And when we think of, and this is the context I feel confident that Nathan was putting this in, that when we think of how would I live my life if the things that I might lose are not really important. And I mean, we always know that we can lose some things, right? And if those things are really important to us that we might potentially lose, if we do something or if we say something, then that keeps you from doing or saying that thing. Are you still with me? But if whatever it is that you perceive you might lose by saying that or doing that, you weigh it against the value of doing that or saying that. And you say, it's more important that I live this way or that I do this or that I say this than that I keep this. And I think Jesus really, really wants us to do that. In fact, you remember anything that he taught that would indicate that he wants you to evaluate what you got on this hand in view of what you can gain on this hand? Remember when he talked about what person that's going to build a tower doesn't sit down and first count the cost, see if he's got enough to finish it? And if he doesn't have enough to finish it, then he's not going to start it. And he also, in that same context, used the story of a guy who goes out to war with someone, and he looks at his army, and he sends some spies to evaluate the opposition. And if he looks at it and decides, okay, if I go to war, I'm going to get beat, and all my men are going to die, and I'm going to die. Then he says, you'll go out and you'll make peace. Right? We do that in life. And we say, okay, if I take this job, if I make this move, if I say this, if I do this, if I talk to this person about the gospel, what am I risking? Well, I'm risking something. You know, is it worth my losing that in order to accomplish this, or at least to try to accomplish this? This is our life, isn't it? And we get to the point that we understand in the New Testament it was written that these people who are overcomers in the book of Revelation did not love their lives so much unto death. They were willing to risk their lives in order to be a Christian. And that's the point at which we must all get. If it's more important to you to live than it is to be righteous, then you might or you might not live, but you're not going to be righteous because you've made a choice. You put your hand to the plow and you look back. You love mother, father, son, or daughter, houses, or land more than me, and you cannot be my disciple. And so as we weigh these things, that's what we're talking about. On this hand, and then on the other hand, we have this. Now, there's something that plays into this reasoning process. And it is that when we're contemplating doing a certain thing in our life or living a certain way in our life or saying a certain thing, and we evaluate what it might cost us to do that. It might cost me my job if I do this. It might cost me the approval of my parents if I do this. It might cost me my life if I do this. Then there's something that plays in this. And this thing is this thing that we call fear. Fear. And it gets itself mixed up in here. And as we're evaluating it, if we haven't made a clear choice about it's worth it, then we start thinking about what it might cost us. And fear tells us, how about if we scale back on this? We don't have to be so bold about talking about the gospel. Or we can, whenever we're commanded to bow down before the world's idol, then we're not necessarily bowing down. We just squat down and we start looking for worms. You know, we're just something we do in our mind to justify, okay, well, it looks like I'm doing this, but I'm not really. And fear plays a very, fear is an incredibly, incredibly powerful thing. Jesus asked some of the most ridiculous questions. And one of them, and I'd like for you to turn to John chapter 5. One of them is in John 5. And we talked about this not too long ago. In fact, Corey had a lesson on it a while back. In John chapter 5, verse 6, Jesus asked a man who had been crippled for 38 years, and he was lying there at the pool of Bethesda. He came up to him and he looked around and he saw all the people, and he went over to this one particular guy And he asked him a really, really strange question. What did he ask him? Do you want to get well? Now, go back and pick up the setting. And by the way, I would say on the surface, that's a really, really ridiculous question. When you put the setting there, particularly, even becomes more ridiculous. Because it says in verse 5, chapter 5, verse 1, sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. And now there is in Jerusalem near the sheep gate a pool, which in Hebrew or Aramaic is called Bethesda. Any of you write in the margin of your Bible what Bethesda means? It means house of mercy. I think it adds to the story here. So there's a pool named House of Mercy, which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, lame, and the paralyzed. One who had been there was an invalid for 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there, knowing that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, do you want to get well? Now, can you imagine walking into, let's just say, a veterans hospital where you have wards and you have a large number of people that are really, really sick, and walking up to somebody's bed that you don't know and say, do you really want to get well? If that guy could, he might get up and hit you. Mightn't he? I mean, what kind of question is that? Well, I would suggest to you that it is a question that calls for painful introspection. But I would also suggest to you that when he asked the question, this guy didn't know that. And he answered the question rather superficially. But it is not a superficial question. And we talked about why Jesus would ask a question like that one time before. You and I had talked about that, those of you that have been here a while. Why would he ask a question like that? I mean, was he doing like we do when we come up to somebody and we pass and we say, well, how are you doing? You know? How many times are we really interested in how that person's doing? Okay, I'm not saying we never are, but lots of times somebody starts telling us how they're doing and we think, oh, no. You know, he's really going to tell me how he's doing, you know. And we just use it as a way to start a conversation. You think Jesus was using that question something? Do you want to get well? I don't think Jesus ever asked anything like that superficially. Now, look at the guy's response. And he said, sir, I have no one to help me in the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. And one of the other gospel accounts gives you more fuller explanation about what that was all about, that an angel stirred the water. And either it did happen or they believed it happened, that the first person that got in after that was healed. So that's kind of a little background of what that was about getting in the pool first. He said he couldn't do it. But Jesus asked the question, do you want to get well? And that was his response. Now, first of all, why would Jesus ask that question? Is there any possibility that the guy wouldn't want to get well? You think that there might have been some things he wasn't willing to do to get well? You think he would have given all the money he had? You think he would have given pretty much everything he had to get well? 38 years, crippled. He had to have people bring him there every day. I think that our weaknesses can become a part of who we are. I think we can learn to live with things missing in our character. So much so that a point can be reached that we don't really want those put back into our character. I'll give you a little simple illustration. When I was in the third grade, 9 years old, it had become obvious that there was something wrong with my eyesight, and so I think it was at school. They used to do, I don't know if they still do or not, but annually they'd give all the kids an eye test. Well, it became obvious I couldn't see very well. And so in the third grade, I got glasses, 9 years old. Since that time, since that day that I got those glasses, when I wake up in the morning, there is not one thing that I reach for before I reach for my glasses. It's the first thing that I reach for. I mean, if the house is burning, okay, I reach for my glasses. Because my eyesight continued to deteriorate for several years until I really, really got afraid that I thought I was going to go blind, because every 6 months I was having to get stronger glasses. And so that was a fear that I had as a kid. And so consequently, I'm pretty sensitive about eyesight. Well, in the last 15 or so years, my girls have just really been on my case to get this, what do you call it, surgery? Yeah, this laser surgery. I don't want that laser surgery. They don't understand that. I don't want it. For one thing, because, it hadn't been done long enough that I know what's going to happen 25 years after you get it. That's one thing. But that's not the main thing. You know what the main thing is? And it's really weird, and you won't understand this. These glasses are a part of who I am. I mean, when I take them off and look in the mirror, I don't like who I see. Really. Now, how weird is that? You know? But if somebody would come up to me and say, what if I could make you see and you wouldn't have to wear glasses for the rest of your life? You know, if it was the Lord, I might say, okay, I don't know. But short of that, I would say, no, thank you. I'm perfectly fine. Now, are there disadvantages to having to wear glasses? Oh, yeah. There are lots of disadvantages. And one of them is that when you get out and mow the yard or work, then you're constantly pulling these things off and wiping your nose because your glasses are sliding down, you know? And they're a pain to wear. And if I had to start wearing them now at this age, you know, I'd do anything to keep from wearing them. But they've been a part of me since I was 9 years old. And they've become a part of me. And so if Jesus came up to me and said, do you want to get well? I might say, no, thank you. And as difficult as it may be to imagine, I think this guy very well, I think there are people who have been infirmed in some way for 38 years. They don't want to get well. For one thing, if you are well, then there's a new level of expectation that's put on you. All of a sudden. You see, there's some things you can't do now because you can't walk. And now, I don't know if he was 38 years, if he was born this way, or if it happened as a young boy, or what happened, but for 38 years, that's a pretty good chunk of your life, isn't it? And he's made adjustments in his life now. And so it's not a superficial question. It's a question that really calls for some painful introspection. Do you want to get well? And it's very possible that if this guy really thought this thing out, I mean, he's going to have an automatic answer. Yeah, I want to get well. But now that he's made well and he goes home, everybody now is going to have different expectations, and he's built his life. There are certain opportunities that may have come his way if he had been walking all of his life that he didn't have. And they may have had to do something with education. They may have had something to do with preparing himself for a vocation that he'd never got to do. And now all of a sudden, he's however many years old, and now he's not on disability anymore, okay? He's not getting paid by the government anymore, and he's got to earn a living now, and he doesn't know how. There's a different level of expectation. And so I'm saying it's very possible, as strange as that question may seem, it's very possible that guy didn't want to get well. I can tell you this, when Jesus did make him well, he faced some new difficulties in his life that he hadn't had when he was crippled. And those may have really upended him. I don't know. We don't know about that. As you look at his answer in verse 7, "Sir," when Jesus asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir, I have no one to help me in the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Characterize for me what you would say his answer was. How did he answer that question? Jesus said, "Do you want to get well?" And he started talking about what? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Instead of giving the answer yes or no, he gave an excuse.
He did, didn't he? You know, my wife's back here, so, you know, she'll talk to me about this later, but it's not totally unheard of at my house when I ask Janice a question that she starts into this explanation and I'll say, "Wait just a second. That's a yes or no question." You know, that's hard sometimes to give a yes or no, isn't it? And sometimes, you know, I might have been known to set the situation up, you know, to want a yes or no when she's not going to give me a yes or no. You know, we've all been put in a position like that before. But did the guy answer his question when he said, "Sir, do you want to get well?" Did he answer his question? Well, yeah, he thought he answered the question. But he didn't really. Not very well anyway, did he? He started telling why he was in this situation. Why it was impossible for this situation to change. And you know, that's all he had thought about for years, whenever, maybe, probably, whenever he was young, first this disability, unless he was born with it, then he started thinking about how he could get well and what he would do if he was well and how he could get out and run with the rest of the kids and how he could do this and how he could do this and how, over a period of time, he didn't think about that much anymore. And he started thinking about why he was in this situation and why that was never going to change. And he satisfied himself with that. And maybe that's a survival technique, you know? You think we ever do things like that? That we got some things in our life that the Lord would say to us, "You want to be free?" And maybe it's a habit that we have. We could start naming some, couldn't we? We all have some that we've struggled with in our life or are struggling with in our life. And what if the Lord came to you and said, "You want to be free?" We'd automatically say yes, but we're doing it because we enjoy it. Or at least we did at one time, and now it's got such a hold on us that we're talking about why I can't stop. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yeah. The comment was, you hear about people winning the lottery and then sometime later, quite often, they say, "I wish I'd never won it." You know? And our lives are that way. Yes, ma'am. Okay, speak as loud as you can. But that's not what Jesus asked him, though, is it?
Jesus asked him, "Do you want to get well?"
And he started telling him why he couldn't, right?
He answered why he can't get well. He can't move from there to there.
Yeah.
He gave him an answer of physical reason. So, in a way, for me, that was an answer of, "I'd like to, but this is why I can't."
Yeah. Right.
He was given his answer.
Yeah. Okay. You know, and I don't know that. That could be, but I would say if that were a possibility and he could get close enough, all he had to do was just roll over, then probably every other crippled person was right there and trying to get themselves in that same situation too, wouldn't it? So I don't know. I don't know if he wanted to get well or not. I don't know. Yes, sir. You think they had quit asking him, how are you doing today? Now, by the way, this wasn't my lesson. This was just a set-up question, all right? My next question that I think Jesus asked that was somewhat ridiculous on the surface was in Matthew chapter 8, if you'd like to turn there, Matthew 8. And thank everybody for your participation. I have a tendency not to let people participate too much because I probably think too highly of what I'm saying. I don't know, but Matthew chapter 8, verse 26. Somebody read verse 26 for me. I'll wait you out.
He replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" He got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm.
Okay, so you remember the setting here, right? You go back up to verse 23, and by the way, the question is, why are you so afraid? And that's really the question I wanted to get to this morning. And I can't say I got sidetracked because I led you there, but just to show that sometimes Jesus asks questions that in reality call for some perhaps painful introspection in how we answer things superficially. Okay? He asked another question. Why are you so afraid? Now let's go back and get the context. And we're in chapter 8, verse 23. He got in the boat and his disciples followed him. Without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake. And by the way, the Greek word is seismos, and it means a great seismograph. We get what? What earthquake? This great earthquake came. And a storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. And if you go and look at some of the other ones, it says the boat was being swamped. Okay, any of you ever been in a boat that's being swamped, that the water is coming in faster than you can get it out? Well, if you're close enough to land that you can swim to land, and if it's relatively calm for some reason, then that's not that big a problem. But if you're out of sight of land, and this is happening, and the waves are several feet tall, and they're breaking over the boat and filling it up, it's a different situation. It says the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was, and the Greek word literally says, peacefully sleeping. He wasn't just taking a cat nap. He was snoring. All right? He was peacefully sleeping. This was this REM sleep, you know, where your eyes are. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we're going to drown." And he replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" Now, I would put that in the category of being a somewhat ridiculous question. What would you say if you were one of the disciples and you went and woke Jesus up and you know, you told him, you know, don't you care that we drown? And he said, "Why are you so afraid?" What would you say? How would you answer that? What? That's exactly what I wrote down. Duh. You know. I mean, you must not be awake yet. Look around you, you know. Who would not be afraid? Right? Anybody in their right mind would be afraid, wouldn't they? I mean, we didn't have a 250 horsepower motor on the back of this thing. we had some sticks that were flat on the end, you know, that our fate rested on here. And so my next question was Jesus afraid? You think Jesus was afraid? He didn't have the slightest fear. Now, my question is, why? Why were they so afraid, and why was he not afraid? Tell me why. I think you hit the word, control. Pardon? What did he say? Tell him what you said again, louder. And the line that I was looking for is, he knows who's in control. Therein lies the difference, right there. Because to them, who was in control? Nobody was in control. This was out of control, right? You ever been in a situation like that? Where you just felt like everything is out of control. You know what we're really saying? Everything is out of my control. And we really do need to make a distinction here. Yes, sir. Let's talk about fear now a little bit. And I've killed all my time nearly, but since we're there. What is fear? What is fear? This is fun. I like to do the same thing when I'm teaching Romans, and I say, we get down to conscience, and I say, what is a conscience? Those of you in Romans class, you heard me do this. What is a conscience? And if you can get past the first word, then you can go. Okay, is it a feeling? Is it a this? Is it a that? That's the first word. That's the hard one, okay? But let's not go to conscience, all right? What is fear?
It's an anxiety that we have over something that might happen.
Okay, which, to take that one step further, which would in some way perhaps be hurtful to us, right? So, fear. And our word, the key word here is anxiety. It is an anxiety. Yeah. It changes your focus, doesn't it? It controls what you focus on, not you. It gains control of your life, fear. And thank you. And here's the point I want to make. Is fear a feeling? It is. Fear is a feeling. All right? If we identify what fear is, we're much more capable of dealing with fear. And that means, and maybe everybody's mind doesn't work the same way, but I need to analyze things in my life in order to deal with them. All right, I have to be able, to be real honest with you, I have to kind of outline things in my life to be able to deal with them. And things that really give me a problem, then I spend lots of time trying to analyze what this thing is, you know. And fear is one of those things. If it is a feeling, then I at least know what I need to address, all right? Because I know some things about feelings. I know that feelings are not always accurate. They're not always reasonable, right? Sometimes feelings are reasonable and sometimes they're not. And so it gives me a way to approach this thing. Yes, somebody had a hand up over here. Yeah. 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 And in this process of fearing, what was the object of what you thought about? Was it not the potential of what might happen? Yeah. And so what you're doing is you're weighing the risk. What if I fail? What if I try this and I'm not, and I get fired? And what if it turns out that I hate this, what I'm doing? And what if, and all of these things, you're weighing what might happen against what's over here. Somebody had a hand. Yes, ma'am. Really? That's interesting. Most of us are flip-flop that. Most of us, like, you know, young people tend to not be afraid of change, and as we get older, we get afraid of change, but that's interesting. Somebody right here had a hand. Yes, sir. Okay. And what is our comfort zone? What I feel like I'm in control of. Right? That's our comfort zone. I think that's exactly right. Somebody else had a hand over here. That's correct. That's correct. That's exactly right. And, you know, Nathan has pointed that out several times in the class, that not all fear. The Lord not only tells us not to be afraid, but he also tells us there are some things we need to be afraid of, right? There are some things in this life. And so it's a protection. It's a protective mechanism, also fear is. But the abuse of it, and when we let it control us unnecessarily and keep from doing things that are right, then it becomes wrong. Yes, ma'am.
I think even though Jesus rebuked the disciples in the boat, that they did what they should have done. They turned the situation over to the Lord. They may not have realized it at the time, but that's what we should do with our fear. Like, one time there was an ice storm, and I thought my daughter was driving all the way to Houston to work. The only thing I could do with that fear was turn it over to the Lord, and I prayed all day long that he'd send her a sign, turn her around, or keep her safe, which was the case. And so with some fears, the only thing that you can do is turn it over to the Lord.
It is. Now, I want to make a point right here. When did they turn it over to the Lord?
When they woke him up to
Satan. And they woke him up when? After they had tried everything they knew, and it obviously wasn't working, right? Then they turned over to the Lord. Now, our trick as Christians is to turn it over to the Lord to start with. And you know what will happen then? There's no reason to fear. Is that right? If we really, 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 really get to where we can turn it over to the Lord, before we think it all depends on us and we run out of resources. Doesn't mean that we're still not going to try to do our very best in this situation, but it means that we live our whole life realizing I'm not in control right now. A year ago, right now, we had big plans to go to Florida and my daughter's wedding in Florida. And everything was in control. We had taken care of where it was going to be. We had put the deposit down on the pavilion where it was going to be on the beach. We had everything worked out with the flowers already paid for. We had the place where we were going to stay paid for. We had all this stuff done. And then something happened that showed me that we weren't in control. I wasn't in control. I had a heart attack. And all of a sudden, all of the best laid plans of mice and men went awry. I mean, here I am, been out several thousand dollars and guaranteeing that this was going to happen. It wasn't going to happen. Fortunately, had some incredible friends here and brethren here who pitched in and made it probably better than it would have been there. And then have the little added addendum here on the end that the guy that we had paid several thousand dollars for this beach house that was three stories and would have about 20-something people sleep in it, called and said, okay, I know, and I know that you were into the time beyond the refund, right? When you don't get any refund back. But I'm telling you, if you'll pick out another week, then I'll give you another week. So, Lord willing, about a month from now, then my family is going to go to Destin, Florida, and we're going to have a week on the beach, for making up for that time that this guy didn't have to do. The Lord's plan is better than mine. And I look back on my life, and I can see that. I just need to remember when things start heating up in my life. Now, I'm going to ask you permission for something. I'm out of time here. This is my outline right here. Okay? This is page two. This is page one. I got right here on my outline. All right? With your permission, it's been an interesting weekend anyway. We had the peak wedding at Belton that took Friday and Saturday, and Nathan asked me to take this class. So with your permission, I'm going to finish this up tonight, if that's okay with you, what I had prepared. Because I want to tell you, we got to a punchline here about being in control, and what I want to share with you is to show why you and I have reason to know that things are never out of control. That somebody is always in control. And I have to know some things about that somebody who's in control. I mean, the Jews could know that somebody was in control in Poland during World War II, but it didn't help them to know that Hitler was in control, did it? So I have to know some things about that person that's in control before it's going to allay my fear. But if it's the right person that's in control, I don't have to be in control. I can be happy I can be even happier that this person's in control than if I were, in fact, in control. Okay? So if that's all right with y'all, I'll do that tonight. Thank you.